Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome to the weekend supercast edition of the show. I've got a quick thing to note on real quick before we get into the free section of this episode. As you all know, if you subscribe to the Realignment via our supercast, you get access to the full version of these conversations. Something that I've long promised, however, is that if you're a subscriber to this show, not only will you support the Realignment, obviously, and get these exclusive conversations, but you will also get an ad-free version of the podcast. So this is a good time to announce that the Realignment is running its first ad this upcoming week. It's going to go through the end of the month. I've literally never taken host read ad before on the show because I have a very, very high standard for what we're trying to do here. I think Athletic Greens are great, but you could get kind of ads for that literally every other podcast that exists. So if I wanted to do an ad, I wanted it to be something that I really believe in and I really consume. And like most of the Realignment's work, helps you all do your jobs better and think about the world. So the quick note here is after you first listen to that first ad on Tuesday's episode, if you don't want to hear that ad for the rest of the month, you should go to realignment.supercast.com to not only get this and other conversations along with your questions answered, but also get the ad-free version of the podcast. And if you are a potential advertiser who's listening, take a look at who I actually advertise with. And if you could kind of meet that editorial standard that we're putting out there, would love for you to get in touch as we move forward. Once again, we will not be pushing consumer goods products on you, though I'm happy to take free ones. Sagar, you get a couple of those fun things every once in a while. So jumping into the free section of the podcast, let's start by talking about the State of the Union, which happened last night. Sagar, you're up super late, so I will make this easy for you, and I will start by giving my reaction, and we can go from there. So number one, I thought the speech worked, but Sagar, you and I are kind of getting in arguments on both sides of this with some of our friends. I think you have to understand what I mean when I say the speech worked. The speech worked because I don't think folks who are either not within Democratic Party elite circles or aren't part of that Democratic Party modern anti-Trump suburban base understand how despondent everyone was the past 2 weeks. Like, it wasn't just like a Fox News take that there was a possibility that Joe Biden was going to get up on stage there and drool, lose his train of thought, not just stutter, but appear utterly lost. Basically, you give some version of like, who am I and what am I doing here? So the purpose of this speech was for Biden to get up there and prove he's not that person and prove that he's not a highlight reel of the TikTok thing. Something that folks may not have seen is Ezra Klein actually did a big piece in the New York Times that he also turned into an audio essay where he basically said, look, I haven't lost faith in Joe Biden as president in terms of being the commander in chief, but I have lost faith in him in terms of running for re-election in 2024. So that piece was very controversial, but it spoke to the fact that Biden actually lost a lot of confidence within the people who he actually really needs to win over. So people should understand the speech that Biden gave as a rebuttal to Ezra Klein and the people who want to be on Biden's side, but were worried about it and also weren't turning out in primaries. That was the purpose. They're going to use the next 6 to 8 months to get independents excited, to speak to Never Trump Republicans, but that wasn't the audience for this speech. And that's why I thought it was a success. What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that the bar, Crystal said this last night, and I agree. If Obama gave that speech, we'd be like, bro, what happened to Obama? But that's not where the bar is. So if the bar is on the floor, I think he mostly put to that a lot of that stuff to rest, which was rumbling in the Democratic Party. Ryan did make a good point, though, that, you know, in the problem is that while this was a State of the Union, he's still going to go off cuff in multiple other events with clips that go viral. So it's not entirely squashed. That said, you know, he rebooted and kind of put some of that to rest of what he needed. And more importantly, he shaped up his base and he gave them the red meat that they were asking for. So overall, I would say it was a success from that point of view. My most annoying criticism that I've seen is people who are like, it was a campaign speech. I'm like, yeah, no shit, dude. It's a State of the Union speech before the fucking election. Like, what do you expect? Trump's speech, last speech before the election, was a campaign speech. You'd be a fucking idiot not to. So
Trump,
I don't know,
gave,
you know,
Rush Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Yeah, it's like this is not a 1990s Aaron Sorkin movie where we talk about soaring angels and heights.
Dude, Marshall, I don't know if you know this. Of the top 100 broadcasts in the United States, the only political event that reaches it is the State of the Union. The only one. I have no idea why. There's a real boomer love for the State of the Union. I don't personally get it, but whatever. My point is just that You'd be an idiot if you didn't take advantage of that. It's the only, like, any politician who's running for office. So I thought that criticism was pretty dumb, and it was not really rooted in reality. Yeah, I mean, look, got a lot of issues with content, got a lot, you know, like structural criticisms and all that, but pure horse race. He did what he needed to do. I personally think he structured the speech in a very bad manner. I would have put IVF right there at the very top. I thought it was a great moment there for Joe Biden, for him politically. The Roe versus Wade call out, we played some of this in our highlight section. When he looked directly at the justices, I thought that was really, really smart. That was and that was all in the first 15 to 30 minutes, although he put it near the back end. The structure was also intelligent on the White House's point of view. They put immigration and Israel, the two issues were the most underwater with the American public at the very, very end. For context, people probably don't know this, but the vast majority of people do not watch the entire State of the Union. The vast majority are only watching the first 15 to 30 minutes. So he put his most politically kind of like good issues for him, Medicare drug pricing, Medicare drug pricing, IVF, Roe versus Wade, and some foreign policy up at the top. And overall, I thought that was intelligent on his point of view. And yeah, he did what he needed to do. And I mean, we already know this. There's just going to be like an absolutely insane media. Like Joe Scarborough was like, that's the best speech a president has given and all of this. And yeah, I mean, that's what he wanted, right? That's so he got, he, look, and this is the thing. People are like, oh, you know, it's like, listen, I don't like Biden, you know, but I can see good politics when I see it. Overall, I thought it was good. We'll see. Will it have lasting impact? Probably not. But, you know, who knows?
Yeah, a weird place where you and I agree, but also like disagree on the fundamentals. Obviously, you and I like disagree on Ukraine policy. But I saw your take about how you didn't like how he placed Ukraine at the top and what happened there. And once again, I agree with your point. But here's what happened there. They put you, because I was thinking like, yeah, why was Ukraine at the tippy, tippy, tip top? They put Ukraine at the top because obviously that was a slight at speaker, you know, Mike Johnson, in terms of like putting the Ukraine bill. So they were trying, look, we're in Congress, we're in the chamber, we're going to put it up top there. The problem is that's just a little too niche, right? So it makes sense narratively why it's there. But to your point around like people only watch 15 or 20 minutes, like no one's thinking on that level. And if what they wanted to do is start with, wait, the only thing that people dislike more than us are the people in Congress, he should have started with reframing the Ukraine issue as the border issue, which is the actual strategy. It's like, hey guys, I'm here. There's a border crisis. Everyone agrees there's a border crisis. Mike Johnson, you're sitting right behind me. Let's do the border crisis. Let's do that and focus on that part of it. And if you're a Republican, you could say that's disingenuous and you could say, oh, well, they actually don't care about the border. They're just using the border to advance Ukraine. But once again, it's a campaign speech. So if they are trying to make a point that they're running against an intransigent Congress, he should have, because remember when he spoke last week in a way that pissed off the left, when he was like, Donald Trump, say you support taking action on the border, I'll do it with you. This actually would have been in the place for him to actually start with that narrative. And then you put Ukraine second, third, fourth, and put that in the like existential MSNBC part of this speech. But I think he should have done what he did, but focused on the border first, then did Ukraine.
See, I would have done IVF. I would have just done IVF right there at the top. I thought it was a brilliant moment from him politically. That's when you take a 90% issue where you have people on the other side and you just hammer it in their face. You have that lady who comes up. And look, he did do it, you know, but he did it, you know, say 15 minutes in. But I thought I would have started with IVF. I would have gone Roe versus Wade. And then from that point forward, I would have rolled into the rest of it. I actually would have put Medicare drug pricing ahead of that as well, just because it's so, so popular for a lot of boomers. So, yeah, look, politically, horse race, the fundamentals still are not strong for Biden. It's got a 38% approval rating headed into the State of the Union. That's the lowest, I believe, for a sitting president in the last 50-something years, maybe 60. Do approval ratings matter in a negative partisanship era? Open question. There's still a lot of fundamentals that are on Biden's side. IVF, special elections. We haven't gotten fully into the Trump, you know, kind of insanity and all of the craziness that could happen. So, you know, I still think he could win. Like, don't get me wrong. And I want people to please take this away. Marshall, when I travel and I meet people who are politically interested, but who are not politically connected, they cannot believe. They're like, well, he's not really going to run, right? And I'm like, where do you get this from?
Do you mean
like,
Joe Biden, running, or do you mean Trump?
No, Joe Biden. They really believe, Marshall, that there's some secret plan to have Gavin Newsom or comma. I'm like, guys, like, this is it. It's
if they
it's
were going to do
happening.
It, they would have done it.
Yeah. You know, JD Vance has a good point about this where he's like, that would require a competence and like conniving and like a competence and intelligence, a strategy of an American elite, which doesn't exist. Like, it's just status quo, guys. Like, they don't have, there's just so much going on that would have to happen, including Biden himself. I mean, Biden is one of the most arrogant men, you know, who's ever lived. Like, you think he's going to willingly step down? No, it's never going to happen. There's just so many things that impact this decision.
Well, here's my actual take here. My take on this was, and this is why I said the State of the Union succeeded. I actually unironically believe that after you had the Ezra Klein Overton window shift with, we should embrace an open convention as being less dangerous than a Biden who literally cannot campaign, there is entirely a world where, because I mean, don't forget this, man, like to your point about Joe Biden's arrogance, President Obama did effectively talk him out of running for president in 2016. So it's not that he can't be dissuaded. And as we've seen with President Obama, like he very much did not endorse Joe Biden in a way that would have been transformative leading into the 2020 campaign. It was only after the initial bit and Super Tuesday that President Obama like sat down the other Democratic candidates. I genuinely think that if Joe Biden had delivered a devastatingly bad performance last night, like if he'd actually had a 10-second senior moment where he's just totally lost, or, and by the way, props to whoever media trained him, when MTG and co were interrupting him and Biden just like kept talking instead of trying to, and he kind of slipped up like when he talked about the illegals thing. And once again, I don't think it was a big deal when he said the word illegal, but clearly like he got a little frazzled and was a little like ineloquent there. Him just persevering through was a real smart move there. But my point is, if he'd done disastrously, there's a world where he gets the Obama sit down and they spend the next 6 months trying to fix everything. And the Ezra Klein piece there really, really matters. So I think the key thing to understand this, to JD's point around competency, is this is actually a case where even Democratic Party elites know that the number of things you'd have to get right to do a Joe Biden switch, it's unfathomable. And well, even like you'd have to guarantee that you'd have to perfectly talk Joe Biden out. You then have to talk Kamala Harris into accepting Joe Biden, not just endorsing her the same day that he steps down. You then have to, like, for example, too, I mean, you all know this, like there's a world where Julian Castro jumps into the Democratic primary and at the actual convention and says, hey, like we need to like run on open borders. Like there's a war, like it would be such chaos that there's just, it's hard to imagine. And there just isn't a candidate who's so strong that everyone would just sit down and back down.
Yeah, so you know what's interesting? I think it was inspired by something you said, plus Masters of the Air. So I went down this crazy World War II rabbit hole, just reading about basically U.S. administration 1939 to 1945. And the level of competence in the American elite at that time made me almost like want to weep with misery just to think about George Marshall and Harry Hopkins, the sense of duty, the people who were around FDR and all that time, where I have this weird look, I'm very pro-democracy. And so it's very tough. I wonder what you think about this. FDR was basically a corpse when they ran him in 44. Like, to be honest, Marshall, we were under a full-blown military coup for, like, what, 7 months? Or in the last, like, 7 months of his life? I don't really know how I feel about that because the American people genuinely didn't know. It worked out fine because Harry Truman, I think, was actually a very good president. But it's one of those where that level of party control plus American institutions, elites, and others that were working under him, I think that was the type of government which may, you know, let's say there was a crazy crisis. He had a real stroke and he was totally incapacitated and all that. I feel like they could have figured something out. But it's like that just, that world doesn't exist anymore. That's just not the world that we're in. The DNC is not a powerful organization, despite what many people think. And the RNC is even weaker than the DNC. It's like that level of like the party elites, the party decides, the back rooms and all that. And I get it. Look, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, zero, but guys, like their power at that time was immense. And more importantly, it was run by some actually very, very smart and competent people. And I don't think that we're living in that time anymore.
Yeah. I mean, my take on that, that's a really interesting point. So I actually wouldn't describe that as like running under a military coup or undemocratic, because like that's a wartime presidency. So in the same way that in the Civil War, that's a total war, right? Company, like, to your point around like 39 to 45 era, the US government didn't allow automobile companies to build cars.
Yeah.
So like in wartime, you're just in such, and this is like the real difference between FDR's time and Joe Biden's time. At that time, FDR is not merely just like a president, like he's unironically like commander in chief.
He's a king.
He's actually a military leader who's writing these in the same way that like Abraham Lincoln was a military leader. And I think in that case, given, and if you actually think about like World War II, what's happening there, like, I, you know what, we both love this history, it's so interesting. And this is actually a real area of criticism that I have over Joe Biden. They could have learned a lot. Joe Biden's obsessed with FDR's presidency. He put FDR's portrait behind him the same way Trump had Andrew Jackson. And that's because Joe Biden really wanted to frame his presidency in a New Deal sense. And I think that's a totally fair, like, center left to left, like, point, whatever, whatever, whatever. The actual problem, though, is that he needed to actually govern like FDR. So here's what, on the decline, third to fourth term, FDR does. He proves he could get the right people in the right positions and delegate power to them and make judgment calls. So I'm going to have George C. Marshall stay in the United States, and I'm going to send Eisenhower to redirect the campaign in Western Europe. I'm going to take these meetings with Joseph Stalin, and yes, like, maybe I'm going to give away too much of Eastern Europe, or you're going to have controversies with Yalta, but at a core level, I'm going to also manage like the decline and fall of the British Empire with like Winston Churchill. He got like the big things correct, and then had actual people who were unabashedly competent. Like, we're going to, there's even perfect example, like Wendell Willkie, who ran against him in 1940. He enlists Wendell Willkie to actually go to England speak to Parliament and speak to the British and work on the wartime alliance. Like, that is just the thing. And this is the biggest Joe Biden problem. I think people would feel less bad about his age if he could basically make, because obviously, you know, FDR is like actually a corpse by the end. Joe Biden isn't a corpse. Like, FDR could not have given the speech that Joe Biden gave in April. If this were March 1945, FDR could not have given that speech. However, what FDR successfully did, though, is convince people that, look, like, I'm minding the shop, I'm in charge there, the buck stops here, but part of my case is I will get the right people in the right jobs. And I just do not think, I think because Joe Biden was a senator and FDR was a governor, he just never got the, like, I hire people, but they're their own people. Like, you know this, like, if you're a Senate staffer, like, you're just staff. Like, even if you're the Senate chief of staff, even if like you're the legislative director, you just do not have autonomy in the right way. A lot of the ways that people critique like Jake Sullivan and Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is that they act too much like staffers and not like quasi-independent figures. And FDR's administration, if you read about it, these are quasi-independent figures and titans. And I just don't think Joe Biden had ever truly empowered them. And I think because he wanted control, and that's your point about arrogance, but I don't think they understood that that actually would have been their argument. Like, if they'd actually gotten the right 10 people and said, look, my job is to not be too woke, my job is to not be too radical, my job is to like basically keep this Democratic Party centered, and oh, by the way, my 50 years in American politics have given me the judgment to pick the 20 people you could actually really, really trust. Pete Buttigieg kind of had this opportunity, but he obviously just wasn't ready for it from a transportation secretary perspective. But like, think of Lina Khan, and she's like controversial politically, but Lina Khan is like a very, very competent person. Imagine an administration that was just sort of like, we have the Lina Khans, the competent versions of Pete Buttigieg, a private sector CEO, but it's like really successful, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they just didn't have the judgment to make that call.
Yeah, that's a smart point. It's true. There's just, man, the level of competence is just amazing. I will say, okay, after reading Stalin's War, I was really radicalized on FDR. After reading some more, though, of Eisenhower, I think I need to stand up for the idea that he didn't, quote unquote, like, stick it to Stalin. And all, this is a totally side conversation. I think a lot of the criticism is genuinely unfair and unfounded, and is like Cold War kookery in terms of like all of these ideas that we had this ability to like stage manage. You know, the main British criticism was like, oh, we shouldn't have gone into the Balkans and ensured integrity of Yugoslavia. And if you go and you read Eisenhower's like wartime memoirs and stuff, in terms of what he actually thought, not some of his retcon Cold War theories, guys, we're trying to win a war. The easiest way to win the war was to allow the Red Army to come in and destroy the Wehrmacht. Not just that, they were taking the vast majority of the casualties. They made the right wartime decision. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of, I was going back and rereading some of the retconning on China. I'm like, this shit is fucking crazy. It was like Chiang Kai-shek was a useless piece of shit who basically took our money. What were we supposed to do? Militarily occupy China as we're fighting this like savage war in the Pacific, and losing, so many guys on Iwo Jima and Saipan. Again, this is a total sidebar, but I think that Sean, what's his name? Sean, the author of
McKeely.
Stalin's War. I don't think he's fair enough in terms of, I think he was so focused on the Eastern European theater that he didn't give enough consideration to like how many problems that the Allies had. And the fact was, is like we were trying to win a war. We were trying to militarily destroy the Nazi Empire and to take Berlin as soon as humanly possible. Another thing I didn't realize too, Marshall, is that because the Britain was so, because Britain was so, what's it called? Was so mobilized for total war. If they even had gone 6 more months, they would have genuinely been bankrupt, like to a point where they would not have recovered. Like ending the war as soon as humanly possible was the absolute correct decision. And a lot of the McCarthy-esque like quarterbacking that happens, I think, Sean gets things correct, Sean McKeegan's on a few things, but grand strategically, I gotta side with FDR and with Eisenhower for a lot of the calls that they made.
So here's the thing. I love this. Actually, I'll probably we should actually just do an episode where we talk about all of our World War II reading because I think we've been on a kick on it. Here's where I'm sympathetic with the critiques of FDR. No, here's where I'm sympathetic to FDR. And this is why FDR was like a great, great, great president. World War II, basically 1938 onwards, is nothing but these like binary choices where you didn't have time to think. You didn't have time just to sort of like sit out and like you had to make judgment calls on the spot. This is what FDR does. I see a hard time choosing the other side of so many of his binary
Yeah,
choices.
I totally agree.
And I think where it counted, he made the right choices. And honestly, where he made the wrong choices, like in the grand scheme of things, like, sorry, those are acceptable losses. You're never gonna get everything right. Here's where I'm most sympathetic to the critique of him. And this actually goes into the FDR becoming a corpse thing. Towards the end of his life, for being so politically prescient and talented, he completely misjudges Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, that's
And
true.
this that, that's that
I
that's
agree.
the really accurate. And that's actually funny enough, like where like age and vitality comes in. The real good critique of him was it's not just that FDR had to make sacrifices about Poland and the Balkans and Eastern Europe at Yalta because the Republican attack during and after World War II was they gave away Yalta, they lost China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not the decision he made, it's how he got there. So what you're saying is something deeply pragmatic. You are saying like, look at the balance of scale here. At the end of the 20th century, what's going to matter? We defeated Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany. If that means we have to sacrifice Poland in the name of wartime unity, in the name of not having to keep going past Berlin and fighting them in Eastern Europe, which is what Patton wanted at the end of his life, that's the correct thing. But you didn't get there where FDR got there by thinking, oh, like it's Uncle Joe Stalin. Like he actually started to believe that this was the left mistake in the early, in the same way that people on the right, this is what Jacob Halborn and I talked about, misunderstood fascists. And like we're like, well, look, like the fascists, they're ultimately about like, pushing back on World War I and these claims that they're this broader thing is just completely unfounded. FDR underestimated the fact that Joseph Stalin wasn't just like a Russian Soviet communist, but he was actually an imperialist. That he actually wanted to control Europe in a way that was detrimental to the area. And I don't think he would have done things quite the way he did things if he hadn't made that political misjudgment.
Yeah, I think some of that is fair, but really who I came through hating is, and this was an interesting thing, especially reading through Eisenhower. Man, the Brits were completely out of control. They're also cowardly, I will say it. They were too afraid of invading Europe, and they could basically did everything they possibly could. He had like a Gallipoli mindset where he's like, well, we're going to the Balkans, we'll do it here, and we'll invade Italy, and we'll do all of these little side quests. And Eisenhower and Marshall are like, no, we need to smash into France, and we need to drive towards Berlin. FDR was constantly having to like manage this coalition where the Brits were obsessed with the idea of maintaining the empire and some sort of like post World War One or so like pre World War One like balance of power ideology, which I think really misunderstood the fundamental war aims and really would have been detrimental to them too in the long run because it would have just kept war going. Again, I know this is a side quest, but reading through it, I'm like, wow, he was really done dirty, I think, FDR, and by a lot of the Republican criticism that was there at the time, because like, what call would you have made? Like, you're really going to make, you know, the China call? Like, you, yeah, okay, you want to militarily occupy China, you want to war against the Japanese there and sacrifice a million American soldiers? No, that's insane. Like, when you make it in terms of practical, like you said, and even people who disagreed with him, you know, all of that at the time, they all went along for a reason. Anyway, I think he made, on balance, he made almost all the right calls at the right
time. Yeah, last thing here, because I know there would be a bunch of folks in the audience who get excited and find a bunch of books about this. The key thing is, here's what Sagar is talking about. So FDR, and this is why like this podcast just does not tolerate FDR slander. Like when you, there's a question we're going to do in the Q&A about like what's something like you learned about when you got to DC, and something that you learn when you hang out on the right in DC, there are just always like libertarians who are like, FDR was a bad president because the Great Depression was not arrested what? By the New Deal. Like, it's like, no, like FDR is a great president. Because he literally led the United States in the Allied world through World War II. And he did the following. This is what you're talking about. So it's 1941. We enter in. It's 1942. You have the Russians are getting slaughtered on the Eastern Front. This is Leningrad is still in the middle of its 900-day siege. Stalingrad hasn't happened yet in terms of the Russians winning. And the Russians are demanding open a Western Front. Open a front to take German forces away from the Eastern Front. So FDR and Marshall have a variety of choices. They could, and this is where I'm sympathetic to the British, but I think they pushed it a year too far. The British point was, we are not ready to invade Western Europe. And they lost, and there, I think there was an invasion at Dieppe in Southern France. It was an actual total disaster.
Yeah, exactly.
It was basically a test. So the British were not ready after winning the Battle of Britain to go into Western Europe. And then the key thing too is the American army wasn't ready either. So FDR says, look, 1942 isn't about Western Europe. It's actually about North Africa. That is a concerted choice. And the whole time Stalin's saying like, oh, come on, get into Western Europe. And then to your point, Sagar, the British were sort of just like, ooh, ooh, ooh. So FDR and them Churchill wants to do the Balkans. What FDR and them do is, no, let's do the soft underbelly, which is Italy. That ends up being a total political, military, strategic misjudgment, because actually Italy was the soft underbelly in the sense that the Italian fascists were like weak and frankly pathetic. But the Germans just took over Italy. And then the Germans were frankly like, Americans never took Italy. Like the Germans were fighting in Italy until the end of the war. It wasn't the soft underbelly. So then it's in 44, but they finally do the invasion of Northern Europe. But that's what we're talking about here. So this got super in the weeds here, but I know that listeners are here because they like stuff. Let's go to the last few minutes of discussion and Q&A. If it's gated for Supercast subscribers, remember, if you'd like to get full access to this episode, go to realignment.supercast.com. Okay, on to the paid section.